Last time we'd gotten down to the 28th verse of the fourth chapter of Deuteronomy. So tonight we'd like to begin in that general vicinity. This chapter is in the position of leading up to the giving again of the Ten Commandments, which we're going to have in the next chapter, chapter 5. And he's telling the people that they're to keep these statutes and these judgments of God so they'll know how to live when they get over into the promised land. And let's go back just a few verses. Say verse 22, Deuteronomy 4. But I must die in this land. I must not go over Jordan. But ye shall go over and possess that good land. Take heed unto yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee. Now this seems to be one of the key problems here, is to be careful not to make the graven image or likeness of anything that he forbid them to make. And he spelled that out earlier in this chapter, like any beast or anything that he named there. This seems to be one of the inherent weaknesses of man, to follow after something as a God, which is not the true and living God. And to have to see and touch and feel something that they can regard as being a God to them, which is, of course, idolatry. This is such an all-encompassing problem. God warns against it time after time after time, and they violate it. Just as surely as he warned against it, they did violate it. And it's present in our society and in our world today. On every hand, we find people following after these graven images. And I mean literally graven images in many cases, and then figurative images in other cases. They want to follow man. They want to follow something they can see and feel and touch. And the religion of God, who is a spirit in this age of the spiritual age, we're no longer living under the letter of the law in which we are the under the schoolmaster, but we're now following the Spirit. We do not have those things. And God has been trying to school his people away from it ever since Mount Sinai. And so this is the general theme now. For the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, even a jealous God. That's verse 24, and we covered that more in detail last time when we connected that with Hebrews, the 12th chapter. When thou shalt beget children and children's children, and ye shall remain long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves, and make a graven image or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of the Lord thy God to provoke him to anger. Now he's making a condition here. He says when, but it really would mean if. If you live in that land for a long time, he says, and if you get on down to the time that you have children's children, and they then make a graven image, or corrupt themselves, or the likeness of anything that does evil in the sight of God, to provoke him to anger. Verse 26, he says, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, that you shall soon utterly perish from off the land, whereunto you go over Jordan to possess it. You shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. And the Revised Standard Version says, you shall be wiped out, instead of saying utterly be destroyed. It made it a little bit more modern language, and we all understand that. This is a promise he made them. This is he promised them he would give them the good things he promised them. If they should violate this thing, he was going to have this happen. And of course, we all know as we studied through Isaiah and as we studied through some of the other passages that this did happen. But here's before it happened, before they ever went into the land. They're standing on the banks of the Jordan River. Before they went into the land, he tells them not to do this, and these are the conditions that'll be brought about if they do it. And he goes on and further talks about these conditions. Now, verse 27. And the Lord shall scatter you among the nations, and ye shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. Now, that did come to pass, and it's still even being brought about today. They've been scattered among the nations. There is probably no nation in which there is not a Jewish culture present and evidences of it having been there. Whether it be Africa or China or Japan or wherever, the Jews have been there, and there are still Jewish cultures there now. This Jewish culture that the Lord set out for how his people were to conduct themselves is so strong until it withstands the ravages of time and different societies and different governments and different continents. It still remains intact. and there ye shall serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. Now you want to make these idols? If you make them, I'm going to provide for the time in which you're going to be scattered, and you'll get to serve idols. And you're going to serve these things that are the work of men's hands. They're going to be made out of wood and stone and various things, and they won't be able to see, hear, or smell, or eat, which means they're inanimate objects. They are dead, inanimate objects. And there you're going to get your chance. It'll be legal. It'll be the law of the land. It'll be something you may not have any choice in. And this reminds me of one passage over in Isaiah, the 28th chapter. I'd like to turn just for a brief moment and refer to that as we're talking here. In Isaiah 28, the people were complaining about the way God taught His Word. They didn't like the way God taught His Word. And so they asked the question to God. Said, whom shall He teach knowledge? Whom shall He make to... Whom shall He make to understand doctrine? This is verse 9, Isaiah 28, verse 9. Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast. They didn't like the way God taught them. He taught them like they were little old babies. He said, you're teaching like we're just weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast. And this is the way God taught. For a precept must be on precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line. Here a little, there a little. They didn't like that kind of teaching. And then Isaiah says, for with stammering lips and another tongue will He speak to this people. Now that's a prophecy telling them that there's coming a time in which you're going to have people speak to you with another tongue. Stammering lips, that is a foreign language. You will not understand what they say. And God's going to speak to you through that kind of language because of your refusal to let Him speak to you the way that He wants to. And on, we could devote a whole lesson to that passage in that chapter. But I just want to refer to that. He predicted with stammering lips and another tongue He's going to speak to you. Here He says, you should serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone which neither see, hear, smell, nor eat. But then He gives another condition, that if that should happen, there is still another condition for these people that which could be met if they wanted to meet it. But if from thence thou shalt seek the Lord thy God, thou shalt find Him, if thou seek Him with all thy heart and with all thy soul. Even when you get into those dire circumstances, scattered among the nations, forced to worship these other idols, or not necessarily forced to, but be put into a position where you're falling into it. If you should decide to seek the Lord then, and you really do it with your heart and your soul, you can do it. You'll be able to seek Him. And this next verse is really, I think, a prophecy that applies to right now. He says, when thou art in tribulation, and all these things are come upon thee, which they surely did, and even are today, even in the latter days. Now, I think that phrase, latter days, refers to this dispensation of time. We're now living in the latter days. He says, when this comes upon you, even in the latter days, if thou shalt turn to the Lord thy God, and shall be obedient unto His voice. Then he has in parentheses, for the Lord thy God is a merciful God. He will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee, nor forget the covenant of thy fathers which He sware unto thee. Now that's, to me, a wonderful and a very meaningful promise. He says, even in the latter days, when you're in tribulation and all these things come upon you, if you'll turn to the Lord thy God, and shall be obedient unto His voice. He'll not forsake thee. He'll not destroy thee. He'll not forget the covenant of thy fathers which He sware unto thee. I think this ties in with the passage there in Romans 11, in which He says that when the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, then all Israel shall be saved. And talking about grafting in the natural branches back into the natural stock, just as easily as He did the wild olive branches, which we are now grafted into the natural stock. So some of these prophecies are very far-reaching. So even today, among the Jewish people, they're now in that situation. They have been scattered among the nations. And they are voluntarily or involuntarily worshiping these idols. For example, whenever Christmas time comes, which is a time filled with idolatry, you find the Jewish people are just as deeply involved in the perpetuating of that. They may not really celebrate it, but they perpetuate it as anybody around. And he says, you can turn from that if you want to, anytime. So this is really a beautiful prophecy. Then he goes on and shows, beginning in verse 32, what a great thing he had done for them up to this point. For ask now of the days that are past, which were before thee, since the day that God created man upon the earth, and ask from the one side of heaven unto the other, whether there hath been any such thing as this great thing is, or hath been heard like it. He said, just go back and ask now from the time man was first created on this earth. Review history from that time to this time. Or ask from one side of heaven to the other. Has God ever done a thing like he's done for you? He's talking about bringing them out of Egypt and giving them the law on Mount Sinai. God's never done that for anybody. It's never been known in the history of the world. Did ever people hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as thou hast heard, and live? They heard him speak from Mount Sinai. He gave them the Ten Commandments with his voice, speaking out of the fire. It was a terrible thing. The whole earth quaked, and the people trembled and feared and didn't want to hear it anymore. It was such a terrible thing. But God said, did ever any people hear that and live like you've done? Or, verse 34, hath God essayed to go and take him a nation from the midst of another nation? When did God ever do that before? Go and take a nation from the midst of another nation, like he did when he brought you out of Egypt. And now he names seven things in this verse by which he brought that about. By temptations, by signs, and by wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by a stretched out arm, and by great terrors. And as we look into those seven things and try to define them a little bit, these are some of the things they could mean. By temptations means to try or to prove. God put forth some things that caused a trial or a proving, not only of his people, but of their captors, of the Egyptians. By signs, this word really means by his presence, by manifesting his presence, by proving and documenting that he was present with them, by signs. And by wonders. This word wonders, as I understand it from the scholars, means type, by types. And a type is it's an object that leaves its imprint in another object so that when it's removed, then its imprint is still left there. And so when God does things that are types of other things, it means that that event left an imprint that's going to be similar to another event. And you can go back and look at that type and see what the other event's going to be like. It may not be identical, but it's going to be so close that you can see that it's an imprint left. And we have many, many things taught in the Bible by types and antitypes. For example, Moses was a type of Christ. That's a very simple thing there. And freeing God from their captivity in Egypt was a type of man today being freed from sin. Crossing over the Red Sea is a type of man today being baptized and so on. He used types here, but it's translated as wonders. And by war, of course, war is the fighting among people and among nations. And by a mighty hand, or that word mighty means strong hand. God showed his power. And by a stretched out arm, and the phrase stretched out arm means mighty operations. And by a great terror, or by great terrors, and that would really be the plagues that he brought upon Egypt, those 10 plagues. According to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes. So he asked the question, did God ever go out and take him a nation from the midst of another nation like he did you? You're the only one that this has happened to. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened since God put man on earth, brought you out of this nation, brought you through the Red Sea, into the wilderness, and gave you his law and spoke to you from Mount Sinai. Now this must have been a pretty important thing in the eyes of God to have done all this for this people. unto thee it was showed, that thou mightest know that the Lord, He is God. There's none else besides Him. Now, that was what the ultimate purpose of all this was, so that you would know that He is God. There's none else besides Him. During this period of history, and of course, this idea really, I think, is a lot more prevalent than we think today in the world. The concept among nations was that there were many gods, and each nation could have its own god or its own group of gods. And that one god was probably about as important as another. You didn't want to offend any of these gods. And so each nation had its own god or its own group of gods. And that's very commonly known. That's not just conjecture. We know that that was the belief. And so what God wanted His people to do was to realize that there wasn't but one God, and that He was that one God. They were not to give any kind of honor or homage or respect or deference to any other thing that should be recognized as a God. But they had the one God. And so He makes this statement, "There is none else besides Him. It was showed unto thee that thou mightest know that the Lord, He is God. There is none else beside Him." And I'm told by reading some of the comments on the book of Ezekiel that this phrase, "There is none else besides Him," is found 62 times in the book of Ezekiel. He keeps repeating it over and over in Ezekiel. And it's repeated again in this chapter, verse 39. So if we get nothing else out of this lesson tonight, but this one indelible point, that there is but one God, there is none else besides Him. Now we see people today on every side implying that there are other gods. They'll even, their phrases, you know, they'll say, "Well, how is it, do the gods smile on you today?" or something like that. Maybe it's just a frivolous, meaningless statement to them. But the implication is that there are other gods. And then there are people who say, "Well, it doesn't matter what god you believe in, just as long as you believe in some kind of a supreme being." This idea is very, very prevalent. And we must not allow this to creep into our way of thinking. There is just one God now. And He has the same standards for all. He has a plan of salvation, but it fits all persons. And for people to get the idea that it just doesn't make too much difference what you believe in or how you believe and on, this is destroying this idea of the one God. And certainly idolatry is definitely an idea that's 100% opposed to this idea of being the one God. "Out of heaven He made thee to hear His voice, that He might instruct thee, and upon earth He showed thee His great fire, and thou heardest His words out of the midst of the fire." Again, having reference to Mount Sinai. Now remember, we're leading up to the giving of the Ten Commandments in the next chapter. So he's just laying the groundwork, preparing their minds. So when we study these Ten Commandments, we will have a concept of the awesomeness of the occasion that led up to it. God didn't just suddenly out of the blue shell out Ten Commandments. He went to a lot of trouble to get them to Mount Sinai, and then the giving of it was a lot of trouble. It wasn't just like somebody standing up and reading off the Ten Commandments. He went to a lot of trouble to present these Ten Commandments to them. And He wanted it to be the greatest thing that had ever happened up to that time. He'd never done anything greater than that in his concept. Now, you think of some great things that have happened. You know, he brought the flood on the earth. That, to me, was a very catastrophic event that we can still see evidences of it today. But here he says it implies that this is the greatest thing He's done. "And because He loved thy fathers, therefore He chose their seed after them, and brought thee out in His sight with His mighty power out of Egypt." Now here's an interesting phrase. It wasn't maybe so much because He loved these people. They hadn't really done that much all that great to prove that they were followers of God. But it was because He loved their fathers. And this goes back to the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the 12 tribes and so on. He had so much love for them that he is still shedding the results of it on their offspring. And he brought them out of Egypt to drive out nations from before thee, greater and mightier than thou art, to bring thee in, to give thee their land for an inheritance, as it is this day. So he names again what his plans are, to drive these nations out that are greater and mightier than thou art. If God loves us to the same extent that he loved those people, then we can conquer things that are greater than and mightier than we are. We don't have to be more powerful than our obstacles are. We can overcome things that are greater and mightier than we are, just like they did. He drove those nations out and gave these people their land for an inheritance, as it is this day. Know therefore this day, and consider it in thine heart, that the Lord, he is God in heaven above, and upon the earth beneath, there is none else. Now here we get this same teaching again, but you must realize that the only source of this teaching was right here. All the other nations round about had a different idea about God. None of them were going to say that this was the true God and that there is none else. Well, that was heresy to say there is none else. And you know, today when we talk about the true church and we talk about faithful Christians and we start talking about there is none else, oh, that rankles people. They think you're some bigoted person. They just cannot stand the very thought that there might only be one faithful church, that Jesus only established one church, and that only the people who follow those principles are the faithful Christians. That's just beyond their any concept. But God's teaching this doctrine way back there. He says, there's none else. I'm the God. There's not any other God. And of course, those who follow any other thing besides the true God, if they follow a different doctrine besides his doctrine, or a different law besides his law, they're not following him. They're following something else. And so they're going on the multi-God theory instead of the one God theory. And the Bible teaches emphatically, there is none else. Thou shalt keep, therefore, his statutes and his commandments. Simple. Here again, we're leading up to these Ten Commandments. He's fixing to give these Ten Commandments. This thing doesn't stop at the end of the fourth chapter. It goes on continuously. And so he's giving them the background. So when he repeats the Ten Commandments, the second giving of the law, then they will have the background. This is definitely important. Thou shalt keep therefore his statutes and his commandments. As we said last time, the word statute means a decreed limit. That's the best definition I can get from looking up several angles of it. A decreed limit. Man must have limits. We talked last time also about how a little child, if he doesn't have limits, he's going to be miserable. If the parents do not set limits and adhere to those limits, make him recognize those limits, he's going to be a miserable child. He will never be contented. He'll come in and destroy a house and never be satisfied even at that. Whereas a child who has limits, he can have this little simplest little toy, sit there and occupy himself with it and be perfectly contented because he knows what the limits are and he's happy to be within those limits. And so it is with man. Man must have limits. There are things that man must be told not to do. Statutes are decreed limits where God has decreed them. He's lined them out. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. We must have limits as well as instructions or commandments as to what positively to do. And part of the Ten Commandments were the limits, and other parts of them were instructions of what to do. And so this is what he says, that you shall keep his statutes and his commandments. Now, in the first part of the chapter, he said statutes and judgments. A judgment is a ruling or a law that's given by a judge. God's going to be the supreme judge. He is the supreme judge. He's the judge of all the earth. As Moses said, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And so when we keep the laws that the judge has given, we know we're satisfying the one we're going to have to ultimately face. We're going to have to ultimately stand before God, this judge, this God. And we're keeping his laws, not somebody else's laws. And so that's what's right. That constitutes then godliness, or that which is righteous or good. So thou shalt keep therefore his statutes and his commandments, which I command thee this day, that it may go well with thee, and with thy children after thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days upon the earth, which the Lord thy God giveth thee forever. Now, what a wonderful statement that is. We all want it to go well with us. We want it to have just one day that goes well. And we're pleased with that, and we're thankful for that. Had a good day today. Went well with us. Well, he tells her the formula for how to get it to go well with you. Keep these statutes and these commandments which I give thee this day, that it may go well with thee. And with thy children after thee. The next thing we want besides something good for us, or maybe even we want it more than something good for us, is for it to go well with our children. We work and we slave and we sacrifice so our children can have it well. We want to provide for them, feed them and clothe them and educate them and get them set up so that they then will be able to have a good life. And God has all this in mind with these laws. And with thy children after thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days upon the earth, which the Lord thy God giveth thee forever. And this is kind of a sequence of man's desires. The first thing is for it to go well with us. The second thing, after we get a little bit more age and a little bit more maturity, is when we have a family, for it to go well with the children. And then when we have things going well with them, then the last thought we may have is that we can prolong our days. When we're in our younger years, we're not thinking too much about prolonging our days. We're not thinking too much about death, maybe. But as we get on older and we see that there's not too much time left, we begin to wonder, how much longer am I going to be able to live? And how can I prolong my days? God's law here is designed to bring those things about, according to what Moses says. Well, we have, beginning in verse 41 for the next few verses, a change of subject. Something else is inserted here before we get on into the Ten Commandments. And so I want to get into that, and then maybe we can finish that subject. It's a very interesting subject, but it seems to be an entirely different change of subject. And then we'll get back into his leading up to and the giving of the Ten Commandments. Verse 41, then Moses severed three cities on this side Jordan toward the sun rising. That is, he set aside three cities on the east side of the Jordan, which would be the side toward the sun rising. You know, at this time, all of them are on the east side. They haven't even got over Jordan yet. Everything's on the east side of the Jordan. There was eventually going to be six of these cities of refuge set aside, but he first of all set the three aside on the east side of the Jordan, that the slayer might flee thither, which should kill his neighbor unawares and hated him not in times past, and that fleeing under one of these cities he might live. Now the purpose of these cities of refuge was for when a person killed somebody accidentally, he could flee to this city of refuge and continue to live. Otherwise, he could be put to death by the avenger, called the Revenger of Blood. And we'll talk about that a little later. Namely, Bezer in the wilderness, in the plain country of the Reubenites. You know, the Reubenites were the tribe to the bottom on the map, to the south. And Ramoth-Gilead of the Gadites. Gad was the center tribe on the east side of Jordan. And Golan in Bashan of the Manassites. And the Manassites were the northern tribe on the east side of the Jordan. So these three cities, one in each of these three tribes, all east of the Jordan then, were set aside for the cities of refuge. Now, to elaborate on this more, I'd like to turn to Numbers chapter 35, and we're going to try to briefly go through that chapter and talk about these cities of refuge. This is a very interesting and intriguing law that God had for his people concerning these cities of refuge. We're going to have to hurry to get through with the time that we have. Verse 35, chapter 35 of Numbers, beginning with the first verse. The first few verses talking about the cities of the Levites. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho, saying, Numbers 35, first verse, command the children of Israel that they give unto the Levites of the inheritance of their possession cities to dwell in, and ye shall also give unto the Levites suburbs for the cities round about them. Now, the Levites, as you know, did not have a tribe that had a territory or a possession. They were a separate tribe that had to do with the priesthood. Certain ones who were coming directly from Aaron could be priests, and the others cared about the affairs of the tabernacle or the temple and other various duties were assigned to them, but they didn't have a territory. So these other tribes that had possessions were to give them cities, cities of the Levites. And the city shall they have to dwell in, and the suburbs of them shall be for their cattle and for their goods and for all their beasts. So they had cities, and then a certain area was designated around the city to be the suburb, to be used like a pasture or a field or for whatever purpose they might need to store for storage or whatever. And the suburbs of the cities which you shall give unto the Levites shall reach from the wall of the city and outward 1,000 cubits round about. Now these next two verses are very confusing. I thought I had them figured out once, and I went back and read them again, and I saw I didn't have it figured out. Verse 4 says they shall have 1,000 cubits, which would be 1,500 feet. But then verse 5 says that they shall have 2,000 cubits. And you shall measure from without the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, and the city shall be in the midst. This shall be to them the suburbs of the cities. Commentators have tried various means to straighten this out. Some versions say that that verse 4 should have said 2,000, like verse 5, so that the two would be compatible. One man, I don't remember his name, said that his idea is that they would have 2,000 plus 1,000, making a total of 3,000. And to me, that sounds like a pretty rational interpretation of this. 3,000 cubits would be 4,500 feet, which would be a little less than a mile. 5,200 feet, I believe, is a mile, or roughly thereabouts. So 45 would be a little over 4/5 of a mile, nearly a mile. Then they would have as a circumference around the city to be the suburbs or the pasture land. The Revised Standard calls it pasture land. And this was for their cattle or whatever they had to have that needed some space. So you see, God had a very interesting setup here. And among the cities, verse 6, which ye shall give unto the Levites, there shall be 6 cities for refuge, which ye shall appoint for the manslayer, that he may flee thither, and to them ye shall add 42 cities. So of these Levitical cities, there was a total of 48, of these Levitical cities, which is where the Levites could live throughout the land now, 6 of them would be cities of refuge, which left 42 other cities. So all the cities which ye shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities. Them shall you give with their suburbs. So the Levite did have a place he could call his own. One of the Levitical cities. Wasn't a territory like the tribes had, but he still could live in one of these 48 cities and be a Levitical city. And the cities which ye shall give shall be the possession of the children of Israel. From them that have many ye shall give many, but from them that have few, ye shall give few. Everyone shall give of his cities unto the Levites according to his inheritance, which he inheriteth. So the amount of cities that each tribe would contribute to this cause would be proportioned to the inheritance that they had. It would average out 4 cities per tribe. And you notice God does many things in numbers of 12 or multiples of 12, so that 48 is a multiple of 12. And if they just each tribe gave the same number, it would have been 4. But he says the ones who had the most possession would give the most cities. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye shall come over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then ye shall appoint you cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the slayer may flee thither, which killeth any person unawares. Now this is for a person who had accidentally killed somebody. Didn't intend to do it. He was innocent of murder, but he had to flee to this city of refuge to save his own life. And they should be unto you cities for refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer die not until he stand before the congregation in judgment. Now this avenger is an interesting phrase here. I searched all I could about it, and there's several people who make emphatic statements about the fact that the avenger is the nearest blood kin to the person who was killed, and it was his duty and his privilege to get revenge by killing the person who had taken his kinsman's life. But nowhere does the Bible say blood kin, except you were to translate this verse 19 where he says the revenger of blood, which means not the not the revenger that gets blood, but the revenger that is closest blood kin. That's the only scriptural reference I can find that says he's next of kin. But this person who had killed somebody inadvertently, if he was met by the nearest of kin or by the avenger, then he was to be killed right there on the spot, even if he'd done it innocently, unless he went to a city of refuge. The only way he could save himself was to go to a city of refuge. Then he stayed in the city of refuge until he stand before the congregation in judgment. So there was a trial. And once the trial was had, then the congregation in judgment decided at that trial, was he innocent or was he guilty? If he was innocent, he stayed in the city of refuge until the high priest died. If he were guilty, then he was turned loose so that the avenger could take his life. And of these cities, which ye shall give six cities, shall ye have for refuge. Ye shall give three cities on this side Jordan, three cities shall ye give in the land of Canaan, which shall be cities of refuge. And we discussed that, three on one side, three on the other side, six cities in all. These six cities shall be a refuge both for the children of Israel and for the stranger and for the sojourner among them, that everyone that killeth a person unawares may flee thither. So anyone in the land, whether a stranger or not, was to follow by this law. And if he smite him with an instrument of iron so that he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he smite him with throwing a stone wherewith he may die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he smite him with an hand weapon of wood, wherewith he may die, and he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The revenger of blood himself shall slay the murderer. When he meeteth him, he shall slay him. Now this is the revenger of blood, or the nearest of kin, was to do this. But if he thrust him of hatred, or hurl at him by lying of wait, that he die, or an enmity smite him with his hand, that he die, he that smote him shall surely be put to death, for he is a murderer. The revenger of blood shall slay the murderer when he meeteth him. So if he did it on purpose, if he hated him, if he did it out of any other purpose except accidentally, he's guilty, and the revenger of blood then would put him to death. But if he thrust him suddenly without enmity, or if cast upon him anything without lying of wait, or with any stone wherewith a man may die, seeing him not, and cast it upon him that he die, and was not his enemy, neither sought his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the revenger of blood according to these judgments. He still had to stand the trial, and they would decide. And the congregation shall deliver the slayer out of the hand of the revenger of blood, and the congregation shall restore him to the city of his refuge, whither he was fled, and he shall abide in it unto the death of the high priest, which was anointed with the holy oil. Now this is an interesting part of this. He had to stay in the city till the high priest died. Now, if the high priest died next year, then he was just there for a short time. But if the high priest was going to live another 25 or 30 years, this man may be there the rest of his life. And it is thought that the idea of having the high priest die before he could be freed, it's thought that that is a type of Christ, who is our high priest, who has to die before we can be freed from our sin and take lawful possession of our inheritance. We cannot have our inheritance. We're allowed to live. We can live on this earth, but we cannot have our inheritance, and we cannot take possession of it until the high priest has died, until his blood then is used in our cause. But if the slayer shall at any time come without the border of the city of his refuge, whether he was fled, and the revenger of blood find him without the borders of the city of his refuge, and the revenger of blood kill the slayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. In other words, if the man was caught outside the city, well, he could be put to death at any time that this revenger found him, and he wouldn't be guilty of murder, because he should have remained in the city of his refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the slayer shall return into the land of his possession. So these things shall be for a statute of judgment unto you throughout your generations and all your dwellings. Whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses, but by one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. One witness could not do it. It had to be more than one witness. Moreover, you shall take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer, which is guilty of death, but shall surely be put to death. In other words, here a person who is guilty of murder, you shall not take any mercy on him or any pity on him or any satisfaction for his life. You shall not commute his sentence in any kind of way. You shall surely put him to death. There is no exception. Take no satisfaction for his life, it says. And you shall take no satisfaction for him that's fled to the city of his refuge, that he should come again to dwell in the land until the death of the priest. In other words, you can't say, well, you've been there 10 years, we'll let you leave now because you've been there long enough. No satisfaction for this until the death of the priest. There's no way you could make any kind of a shortening of the sentence. He's very emphatic in that. So ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood, it defileth the land. Now, this is an important part of this. Blood defileth the land. That is, when a person was murdered or put to death on the land, that land was defiled and considered to be a guilty piece of land. And the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. So the only way that this land could be freed from this curse and this defilement was for the blood of him that shed it to also be shed. Now that's a very interesting point. This is a part of God's law. We're told that whosoever liveth by the sword shall die by the sword. And this law dates back to Genesis 9 and 6. I'd like to turn to read that. Where the law of the patriarchs was set in force about this very thing, Genesis 9 and 6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. Now this was the law of a patriarch from the very beginning, and God intended for that to go right on through. So the person who sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. He did make a provision where that could be circumvented in the case of a person who had accidentally killed someone. And that was to go to the city of refuge, stand trial, and if you're found to be innocent, then you stay there till the death of the high priest. And so he says in the last verse, verse 34, defile not therefore the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I the Lord dwell among the children of Israel. So we see an interesting thing here about God's feelings about a person being put to death. If his blood is shed, the land is defiled, and the only way you can cleanse that land of that defilement is to shed the blood of the one who committed the crime. So, even an accidental death, which was at your hands, you still had some kind of guilt, there was some kind of defilement, and God did not just overlook it. There had to be this penalty paid and these procedures gone through with. So, since we did have mentioned in our chapter tonight about the cities of refuge, I thought we'd just go in and delve into those and give an explanation of them so we would understand what they're talking about when they say that, because there's more of that given in the book of Deuteronomy, but I wanted to get it when it was first mentioned. Well, I believe that we're going to go ahead and close our lesson at that point tonight, and then next time there's just a few verses left in this fourth chapter. We'll finish those and get on into the fifth chapter, Lord willing. Anyone have any comments or questions about the part of the lesson that we've studied tonight?
Back in Numbers 35, where they use the word congregation, who made up this congregation?
Well, I can't tell you offhand, but it seems from what comes to my memory is that the elders of the city are the ones who did this type of thing. The elders of the city would conduct a sort of a court or a hearing. And also Moses had set up these system of judges where you had one over 10 and another over 100.